Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. He's speaking to us from South Florida. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for inviting me on, Jim. It is always a pleasure.
How did the markets react to the Fed not hiking rates this time around?
Well, as Bloomberg put it, they went all in on the idea of, if not a pivot, certainly something that seems a little dovish. But my gut feeling is that that Powell isn't done yet.
You think he's going to hike again?
Yeah, I do, and it really goes deeper than all the blather about you know, inflation and wage inflation and this and that. I think that Powell really stands as he's on the ramparts, really, in a war that is being fought globally and economically against the globalists, or between the globalists and the rest of us. And the strong dollar puts them all in a bad position. You know, the only reason that we've been subjugated by Brussels is it's the free money. You know, the whole globalist enterprise was never really viable unless they had recourse to unlimited sums to buy whatever they needed to buy to implement their plan. So Powell, by forcing the dollar up, and the dollar is getting hit again today, but don't mistake that for the end of the dollar. It ain't happening. So anyway, Powell is really kind of on the ramparts there. Not saying anything about it. He can't really give away his game that it has to do with, it's a lot bigger than just fighting inflation. He's essentially cutting off the air supply of all these plotters and planners who have essentially commandeered the global economic system slowly but surely since 1913, when the Federal Reserve was established.
What does that tell you about investors? What should they be doing in this kind of environment?
Whatever exactly the opposite of whatever they woke up thinking they should do this morning. You know, they should basically be getting their houses in order, cultivating vegetables that will be high in nutrition in their backyards. And we're going to wake up one day and the banking system will be closed for the week. And I've been doing some interesting reading. There's a fellow named Rogers who's out there. You can Google this. It's called The Great Taking, and he was talking about the bank holiday under Roosevelt's fire chats, and the bank holiday that supposedly saved the banking system from utter collapse in 1933. And, you know, there's an interesting question about why the rich had to take their kids out of private school if the banks reopen. But in fact, a lot of the rich didn't have their money in the right banks, and the banks that reopened following the bank holiday were only those with that were sanctioned by the Federal Reserve. So a lot of banks were allowed to fail, and the assets of the rich and the middle class and everybody else.
Do you think more banking failures will show up in the new year?
Well, it's funny how a few of them happened, and there was no there was not really a monetary response. You know, there was at the level of swaps and repos, I guess, which is where it all happens, this idea that if any bank really needs the money, it's there. But there was not kind of a headline monetary response. And it was telling, really, because it was basically saying, we know, that's capital W, we know that the banking system is in jeopardy, and that these regional banks and some of the bigger banks we'll let them fail. I mean, it can happen, and that's still the case. It's not like the banking system is in great shape. And, you know, some people look at and think, well, the deposits are insured, but they're only insured for, you know, 1 or 2% of the notional value of their holdings. A big bank like, you know, B of A might hold $70 trillion. That's with a T, capital T. $70 trillion worth of derivatives. So you can imagine what a $100 billion credit line with the Fed is worth if the FDIC has to bail out more than one and a half regional banks. So the system is egregiously underinsured, but that was all, according to this great taking, it was all part of the plan, really. So... So, we're going to have a lot of banking problems that arise mainly from a strong dollar. You know, some of the commentators out there, the gurus, are talking about it's over for the dollar. I have to respectfully say they're full of hooey. You know, the whole derivatives market and essentially all borrowing of dollars represents nothing but a short position against the dollar. And you'd have to come from a trading background, as I did, to appreciate the fact that absolute garbage can go to 100 times its, you know, the stocks, where the companies are worthless, the stocks go bananas. And it's all just short squeeze, that's all. So in the same way, the dollar, which is fundamentally worthless, it's just a debt, it's an IOU, it can go to an extreme level of valuation. And that's what's going to happen because, as I said, the world has amassed a huge short position against the dollar. And the mere fact of that, and the fact that the last thing in the world that we should want then is a strong dollar. That's what's going to make the strong dollar happen. But even now, the strong dollar is putting a lot of pressure on all banking entities, on all debtors. And of course, Europe is at the head of the line as far as making it cheap to borrow money.
Well, talk about a so-called worthless currency. How about Bitcoin? There's absolutely nothing behind it. Nothing.
Yeah, Bitcoin is worse than worthless. It's just a stupid, idiotic lie. I've been hugely bullish on Bitcoin simply because there's no one willing to supply it into the markets, let alone short it. So Bitcoin is sort of wafting higher on an absence of supply. The demand part of it is, I guess, foolish enough to drive it, but it's mainly the lack of resistance from above. So Bitcoin, I've never heard anyone in the Bitcoin world, even the big players like Saylor, even come close to explaining why Bitcoin should be worth anything. You know, I concede that because the blockchain itself has utility for recording transactions securely, that yes, Bitcoin should have some value. But I would say just to make Bitcoin useful in transactions, the value should be no more than, let's say $1.50 to $2.50. But at $70,000, I would say it's a tad overpriced. And, you know, from the beginning, the whole Bitcoin story as to valuation, you know, why should it be worth anything? The only idiotic reason given for the answer is, well, because it's scarce. But if scarcity were the only condition required for money, then, well, we'd have a lot more of it in many forms. So Bitcoin is a big hoax, and but again, I'm pretty bullish on the price movement because no supply.
Bitcoin, isn't it more or less like a game of musical chairs? Like at the end, somebody wins, but everybody else lost.
Well, it's certainly a pyramid and a greater fool operation, a con job, but in terms, it's much more complex than musical chairs, because if you go back to the scarcity thing and you take the initial 21 million Bitcoin minted by the mythical Satoshi, as you got closer to the threshold, the limit of Bitcoin, the cap of 21 million units, it became more difficult to solve the blockchain, to extend it, to create another Bitcoin. So the idea, you know, when you get up 18, 19, 20, I don't know where we are now, 20 million Bitcoin, it takes a lot, everybody's working on the computation, their computers are overheating to solve the blockchain, so it takes an enormous amount of energy to create that additional, you know, that additional Bitcoin at the margin. So it's worse than a zero-sum game. It's really depleting the world of energy. It's a waste of energy. Except for the one blockchain problem solver who winds up with the prize.
We'll have more with Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, before we went to air, we were talking about the retail system and shopping malls, and you're saying the U.S. economy relying on Black Friday to bring their balance books back every year is kind of a folly.
It is kind of stupid and comical, really, that this greatest superpower, economic power on earth, each year found itself desperate for a quote-unquote Santa rally. So much of the retail revenues are booked in the holiday season that it's really true. We need a lot of shopping. Everybody's got to buy toasters and neckties and automobiles with ribbons tied around them to keep the economy running. You know, the economy, GDP, the consumption component is like 70%. So we really need to shop till we drop. And to me, that was never really a good way to run an economy. You know, better we should be manufacturing things, solving problems in science like fusion energy and battery storage and things like that. But instead, we're more focused on the microwave ovens. So this year, we're apparently getting a little boost, a little turbo boost from Powell's not quite pivot the other day, but apparently the stock market is going bananas and the shoppers are out in droves, and all credit going to Powell. I was in a mall yesterday down here in South Florida where all the money still is, and they can actually operate a mall in a way they used to. It looks like the 1980s. There are actual shoppers in there, and I don't mean just in the Apple store. And there are a lot of stores that are companies that you thought went bankrupt 15 years ago, one of them being Abercrombie and Fitch. So someone's operating an Abercrombie store in the town center mall, the Boca Mall. And it's just a high-end mall. There's a Nordstrom's there. There are even shoppers at Macy's. They've got Neiman and Marcus. They've got Saks. So all the big, big expensive department stores are still there, and they're healthy. So it was really like time travel back into the 80s.
Well, what about all the malls who plan to be something different now? Because obviously the shoppers aren't there to support 100 little stores?
Well, the malls, the single, mostly single-story malls, are an easier conversion than a 40-story office tower in San Francisco. You know, even as to interior space, you know, interior walls and things like that, and apartments not having windows. But the shopping mall makes an easier conversion, especially for mixed usage, because, of course, you can sort of determine how much retail you'll need to make it self-supporting in a way, or self-sustaining. So, but the problem is there are a lot too many, there's so many malls that, that can be converted for that use. The question becomes, what businesses will occupy them? And, you know, the answer is we've already got enough dental offices and little, you know, some of these outpatient clinics are filling some of the holes, but there's not enough business really being done at a brick and mortar level to fill all the malls to do all these conversions. But fortunately, there are scavengers out there who buy malls for 10 cents on a dollar, and they figured out how to make a profit with just straight retail. So, but you know, the great wind down has been going on for years, and eventually it'll encompass the last remaining big boxes, among which I include movie theaters.
Yeah. Now, in the Vancouver area, several malls, including the largest mall in British Columbia, are being torn down. Metrotown Mall, they're going to put up residential towers and just have street-level retail with actual streets where people can walk again.
Uh-huh. You know, when I think of those conversions, like in San Francisco, done presumably by idiots with somehow too much more money in financing than they deserve, I think, okay, some guy buys an office building and they're going to convert it. But to sort of put it in a more, in an imaginative way that anybody can understand, when that building empties out in San Francisco at 8 a.m., everybody's on their way to, well, where? You know, fill in the blank. Are they on their way to jobs? Not in San Francisco. You know, the job market has imploded there, even though some of the hucksters are out there saying, oh, you know, AI will bring the city back and there's tons of jobs. But when you convert that building and you fill it with tenants, just try to imagine, well, who are they? And when they get up in the morning and they exit out the front door, where are they going? You know, and in San Francisco, unfortunately, the answer is they're going to defecate on the sidewalk on Market Street.
Oh, dear.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
Yes.
But seriously, I mean, that's a legitimate question. When the building empties out in the morning, how are they dressed? Are they wearing business suits? Where are they going? And certainly in San Francisco, they're not wearing business suits. You know, if they're lucky, they're you know, they're in some consulting, some contractor job they took when Twitter let them go.
Is San Francisco going to be able to come back?
No, it is so far from the bottom that you have to look at the defecated on streets and everything else. It's in a relative state of nirvana right now. When you look at the convention calendar going out 7-8 years, it gets thinner and thinner and thinner. And even now, while there's still even, you know, there's still a little convention business there, all half the stores in Union Square shut down, and, you know, half the ones on Market Street. So San Francisco is so far off the bottom, it boggles the imagination to think what it's going to be like. It's going to look like Blade Runner.
Yeah, at least in Blade Runner, they had flying cars.
Yeah, in a dystopian context where it was always raining, you know, but I'm afraid that's what we're coming to. In what was once a beautiful place.
What's the future for crude?
It mystifies me. It's a lot like gold, you know. You see it going down, 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 and you wonder why. In the case of gold, we know that it just gets these takedowns happen because the gold market is manipulated entirely by a bunch of scumballs, and they have a built-in arb against paper gold that gives them the ability. This, according to one of my old subscribers, Andy McGuire, that they've got sort of a $90 to $100 cushion to arb gold to take it down, up and down over $90 or $100 with no real meaning, no damage to their own portfolios. So here's oil coming down, and I've never been a believer that supply side management could really make things happen in gold. You know, the threat that OPEC was going to curtail supply. What really drives organic bull markets in energy is demand. You need the Chinese economy to be resurgent, to be, you know, for manufacturing there to be on the upswing. But trying to keep the price of oil up just by curtailing supply in a weakening market never seemed like a winning strategy. So here we are with crude just coming down, and it's really kind of just for the swiftness of the decline in crude prices, it's kind of overshot my own logic. I'm thinking, geez, when is it going to pick a bottom here? I don't know. I'm looking for a turn in crude. I have something very specific to that in my my technical analysis at rickackerman.com. That for this rally in crude to be for real, it needs to. I wish I could tell you, but I've got my computer is on like a 90-second lag right now, overloaded with memory chores, I think. But so we've had this so far fledgling rally in crude, and maybe it represents an important turn, but I tend to doubt it.
Now, you like to take a look at certain stocks that are bellwethers for the whole market. Apple and Microsoft, how are they going to do?
Well, I used Apple as a steady bellwether, my kind of tell-all stock, the idea being that if you get Apple right, you had the market right. And I still believe that. I don't think it's rocket science. You don't have to tune in to CNBC or read Bloomberg's or the Wall Street Journal. If you want to know where the market's going, you just look at one or two stocks. And so I looked at Apple, but Apple became a laggard. And I think it's because of the perception that they are no longer capable of innovating themselves out of a wet paper bag. And, certainly they sell a lot of iPhones, but the sales would be very vulnerable, more than most retail goods, in a recession. So I think that's already priced into Apple, as are its well-known troubles in the China market. So Apple has real problems. Microsoft does not. You know, Microsoft has put everything on a subscription basis, and we're all going to send them our annual subscription money every year. So to me, Microsoft is really, that's the linchpin. It's really the strongest stock in the world. And for that reason, if you're instead of theorizing about, you know, when the end is coming, when the sky is going to fall, you just follow Microsoft. That's all. And you cannot possibly get it wrong. If Microsoft is going higher, then the market's going higher. So you couple that with a good technical analysis method, like the one I use, and you can see that Microsoft has a very clear target of $430. It's currently getting absolutely pummeled today. Down, it was down as much as $7 or $8, or about 2%. It's currently trading $367, $368. So it's got a 60-some dollar rally ahead of it. But when Microsoft gets to 430, that's the fat lady singing. You know, everybody's waiting. They say they don't ring a bell at the top. The bell will ring when Microsoft hits 430. So just be sure that your vegetable garden is in good shape, and the doubloons that you buried in your backyard are easily accessible.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
I think we've covered it all, Jim. I would say the most important thing in terms of investment strategy is that this weak dollar is not going to continue. I don't mean to suggest it's going to turn around tomorrow, because when the dollar starts strengthening, that will be the clarion call. It'll be, Armageddon is right around the bend. So just be sure that you don't owe too much money, because any encumbrance is going to come back at you with tenfold strength, and just keep your cool while the market goes higher.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Always a pleasure, Jim. I really appreciate the invitation to connect with your audience.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks. His website, rickackerman.com. If you have any questions for Rick or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at House Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.